Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Law, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Jane Richards, the host of the channel. Today we'll be talking to Nicola Lacey. Nicola is a school professor of law, gender and social policy at the London School of Economics. In addition to other positions she's held at Harvard and Oxford, she's also the recipient of a number of prestigious accolades, including, most recently, she was awarded a CBE for her services to law, justice and gender politics. Now, for North American listeners, a CBE stands for the Commander of the Order of the British Empire. It is the highest ranking order of the British Empire Award. It is awarded to recognise the positive impact made by a person in their work. So we're very privileged to have Nicola speaking to us today. Now, coincidentally, Nicola was awarded her CBE in the year after her book that we're here to talk about today. It was published by Oxford University Press 2016. And Nicola's latest book is In Search of Criminal Responsibility, Ideas, Interests and Institutions. Nicola Lacey, thank you for taking the time to speak to me today, and welcome to the show.
Thank you, Jane, for inviting me. It's a great pleasure to be here.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine, believe me. Now, can you begin by telling me a little bit about yourself and your work, and also how you came to write In Search of Criminal Responsibility, Ideas, Interests and Institutions?
Yes, of course. So I'm, in terms of my substantive legal scholarship, criminal law has really always been my main field, although I've done lots of different things, feminist theory, biography, but criminal law is really my substantive field and remains my main interest. And in the early 90s, I was very interested in the critical legal studies movement, and I was very much involved in working with other scholars like Celia Wells and Alan Norrie in developing sort of critical approaches to criminal law. In other words, approaches that really tried to understand not just how the rules fitted together, but really the sort of broader forces that shape them and perhaps shape their interpretation in ways that are less obvious than those usually the subject of sort of, let's say, a standard criminal law textbook. And we were, Alan and Celia and I were all involved in writing sort of critical textbooks. But as I went on with that work, I wrote that book with Celia when I was working in Oxford, and I moved to Birkbeck College in London for a couple of years, and I was working with a very interesting criminal law scholar called Lindsay Farmer, who was very interested in legal history. And I started to think that looking at the historical development of legal ideas was a really, really useful way of getting a sort of constructively critical perspective on how legal concepts, doctrines, rules, arrangements, and protocols relate to broader social, economic, and political ideas and institutions. So I started working really on some of the historical materials on criminal law, some of the classic things like Blackstone's commentaries. And in the late 90s, I published a piece which in a way is the fountain of all the work on this area that has come since, which really compared Blackstone's commentaries James Fitzjames Stephen's famous Code of Criminal Law at the end of the 19th century. So Blackstone's commentaries were in the middle of the 18th century. Stephen in the middle to late 19th century. And then Glanville Williams's very famous textbook of criminal law, first published in the 1950s, called Criminal Law, the General Part. And what you could really see by juxtaposing those three 18th, 19th, and 20th century influential commentaries or codes was that the fundamental structure of the way we thought about the organization of criminal law had changed, and that whereas by the time Williams was writing in the 1950s, he never got round to writing the second volume of his book, which would have been on the special part, in other words, the criminal offenses, because it really the whole weight of legitimation of criminal law seemed to have turned on the so-called general part, in other words, the principles of conduct and responsibility and fault and defense, which had really become the main preoccupation of criminal legal scholarship, whereas for Blackstone, those weren't important at all. And that initial historical work just really fed my interest in how criminal law had developed, and in particular started to feed into my development of what I would call a sort of institutional approach to criminal law scholarship. In other words, trying to get away from the idea, which I think has affected some critical legal scholarship as much as, say, traditional doctrinal legal scholarship, trying to get away from the idea that criminal law is, or law in general, is all about rules and doctrines. I wanted to suggest instead that the way in which those rules and doctrines and principles and understandings are embedded in institutions like the trial, like the judiciary, the magistracy, the way prosecution is organized, all these different components of a criminal justice system, indeed of a legal system, the way the rules are institutionalized in those systems is hugely important to the way they develop and the role which they play in society. And in turn, those institutions are, of course, shaped by the distribution of interests and power. And so that's really where the title of my book came from, Ideas, Interests, and Institutions. I wanted to come up with an account of criminal law which tried to put the, if I can put it in this way, the co-evolution of those three layers of legal reality together. And if I can just illustrate with one very brief point, and I'll stop and let you ask another question, just to make this point about institutions. We think today, even though we know that a contested criminal trial is actually a very rare event, most countries, the vast majority of criminal cases are heard in summary forms of justice or result in a guilty plea. But we still somehow think of very often that the contested trial in some systems with a jury as a trier of fact, as the sort of acme of what it is to test the veracity of a criminal case, the justification of a criminal case. And that takes place, of course, within a framework of a very elaborate set of rules of evidence and procedure. But if you happen to know, as legal historians have worked out from court records, that the average length of a criminal trial, a felony trial, in the late 18th century English criminal justice system was something like 20 minutes. You have to ask yourself whether the institution that was delivering that 18th century standard felony trial was anything like the same kind of institution that we have today, whether it was really an institution that was in any way equipped or designed to investigate guilt in the sense of mens rea as well as actus reus in the way that we've set up the criminal trial in the 20th century. So really basic things like, you know, who's hearing the criminal case, how long does it take, what rules of evidence are there become incredibly important to the whole meaning and significance of criminal law, or indeed any other kind of law.
Yeah, thank you. I think that's really interesting because, as you say, one of the key ideas in your book is looking at how interests shape the notion of responsibility. And you do give this historical context. So because we do in our analysis, you know, especially, you know, in law school as a junior lawyer, you learn to kind of do doctrinal analysis. But I think what you're arguing is that actually there are these other influences on doctrines and on the legal system, which, you know, we don't necessarily take into account when we're reading law on the books, as you describe it.
That's right.
So what I'm interested in terms of the institutions is, can you elaborate a little bit more on the types of institutions that do shape the criminal law, and especially the notion of responsibility, and how do you say that they have, how have they changed responsibility?
Well, I think my core idea is that responsibility is doing a sort of, in a way, a practical task within criminal law. It is, in a sense, legitimating the criminal justice system. It's the thing that we appeal to explain why the imposition of penal power is justified rather than simply, an exertion of force. But the way in which we think about what form of responsibility is appropriate has changed over time, and that is shaped partly by institutions, but partly by ideas as well. So perhaps it's important to start with the argument in the book that there are actually three or possibly four quite different ways of thinking about responsibility that arise within the history of English criminal law, and I think we could find the same in quite a number of systems. There's the idea that responsibility, in some sense, reflects an expression of capacity, in the sense that an agent, the defendant, has acted with the relevant understanding and powers of self-control. That's perhaps the most familiar form of responsibility as we think about it today. There's, I think, more prominent in the 18th century, but perhaps having a bit of a revival today, the idea that when we talk about holding people responsible, what we're really talking about is something about the quality of their character or the quality of their action. It's a kind of evaluation of it's sort of quasi-moral evaluation of character. Thirdly, we think about responsibility in terms of our relationship with things that we cause, outcomes that we cause. So I might accidentally cause somebody harm, and that we might think of as a different form of responsibility from intentional responsibility. But nonetheless, we would negatively evaluate somebody who simply shrugged their shoulders and said, I had nothing to do with it because it was an accident. And then sometimes we think about responsibility as founded in somebody presenting a risk of a certain kind, as in concepts of dangerousness, for example. And my argument in the book is that all of those ideas of responsibility have been influential at different times in the history of English criminal law. There are more than one at play, but their balance changes. And what changes that balance, what affects that balance, is first of all culture, in other words, the shape of broader ideas about human beings and what makes them tick and what makes them accountable to each other and their relationship with the state. Secondly, interest, and perhaps law and power, and we'll perhaps come back to that. But thirdly, institutions. You asked me specifically about institutions, and I would say you could start slow seminal process, the institutional arrangements, the institutional arrangements, the legal profession. We have to remember that the legal profession organized in the modern, centralized, very regulated way that we have today is basically a 19th century invention. And of course, there were sort of professional organizations before that, but there was nothing like the organization developed with professional associations in the 1970s, protocols about what the obligations are of a lawyer, a defense lawyer, say, to not only their client, but also the court and implicitly the state or the system, are hugely developing and are expressed through institutional arrangements like the organization of courts, the distribution of personnel, and so on. And what we're seeing in the 19th century in the English system is a tremendous centralization, professionalization, and centralization of criminal justice, a huge increase in the intensity of the rules of evidence, but lots of reorganization and sort of professionalization of personnel. And that I argue in the book with lots of examples, is very, very important to the way the system develops.
Yeah, thank you. That's also, again, really interesting. And so I think what you argue in the book is that, and as you just said, capacity is one of the primary ways now that mens rea is judged, but there is being a revival in the ideas of character and risk, especially in terms of how responsibility is attributed. Can you talk a little bit more about how this is happening, please?
Yeah, so I mean, obviously most of my examples in the book are from the English system, and it's interesting to know how that compares with other systems. But what we've seen definitely over the last 20 years or so, which has attracted quite a lot of critical comment, is the revival of a certain kind of, as we might put it, preventive justice, or set of what we might call hybrid arrangements. So examples would be, obviously, there has always been some sort of preventive impulse in English criminal law. We've always had inchoate offences like attempt. We have very long-standing things like the offence of breach of the peace, which is a sort of preventive offence. We have various offences like possession offences. So it's not that there hasn't been preventive justice always in the English system. But in a number of areas, there's been a real intensification of these sorts of offences. So terrorism would be the most obvious example, where we now have offences of preparation, which push the boundaries of criminal liability way back before, much earlier than the law of attempt, for example, would already have taken them. We have many offences that have to do with membership. So these are sort of offences that take group membership or association as a sort of proxy for dangerousness. So there has been an efflorescence of what you might call pre-inchoate offences. On top of that, we've had the development and massive proliferation of hybrid orders, so-called preventive orders, of which the most famous no longer exists anymore, but it's a good example, the antisocial behavior order. This was the first one. And the antisocial behavior order was something that it was essentially a civil order that something like a local authority could apply for if they had, let's say, a young person being disruptive on a housing estate or something of that nature. And it was just a civil order, civil standard of proof, no criminal procedural safeguards. But in effect, the breach of an antisocial behavior order was a criminal offense. And so this was a sort of hybrid criminal-civil offense. And we now have literally dozens and dozens and dozens of these. We have forced marriage prevention orders, we have park restriction prevention orders, we have alcohol use prevention orders. And essentially what this has done is to, again, move forward in time, or rather move back in time, the boundaries of criminal liability, but to do so in a patterned way based on what you might call a kind of character risk hybrid pattern of responsibility attribution. In other words, you particularly target, in the way these offences are structured, forms of association or group or activity which you associate with a certain kind of risk. And one of the worries, of course, in any system that is ostensibly committed to a sort of the rule of law and equality before the law, is whether these sorts of offences, either in practice or possibly even in design, actually disproportionately target certain sectors of the population.
Yeah, no, and I think that relates to your argument in the book about how responsibility and this kind of notion of responsibility, especially in relation to, I think, character and this increase in assessing responsibility in terms of risk, it relates to how responsibility is kind of used as a mechanism of social control coordinating social behavior, I think, is how you describe it. Can you talk a little about what you mean about by that?
Yes, absolutely. So I think one of the other things that's probably quite an important implicit feature of my book, which is different from many works of criminal law theory, if I can put it that way, is that I don't really see the criminal law as a sort of heavily moralized mechanism of social regulation. I see it more in terms of a system of coordination of facilitating peaceful coexistence. I don't see it as a sort of subset of personal morality. Of course, I accept, as anybody sensible has to, that there is an overlap, in fact, between rules of the criminal law system and certain important moral norms, like norms against about honesty and physical integrity and so on. But I don't see criminal law as a sort of quasi-moral system. And so I see the responsibility principle, which has become so central to the way we think about criminal law, in terms not merely of being a mechanism that helps to legitimate the criminal law, to explain why it's a fair and a legitimate system, insofar as it is, but also, importantly, to coordinate the expectations of both actors in society and officials in the criminal justice system as to what sorts of criteria have to be brought into play before somebody can legitimately be convicted of a criminal offence. So responsibility principles have these two rather different functions in my account. They're legitimating, they're sending a message about what justifies the state's action, but they're also sending coordinating messages to actors within the process, both lay actors and officials, about what criteria have to be met in order for the coordinating power of criminal law legitimately to be invoked.
Yeah, and so coming back to that point about legitimating the power of the state, how do you see criminal law doing this?
Well, in an ideal world, it would be doing it by setting up fair, even-handedly applied arrangements which facilitate peaceful coexistence and good coordination. And I've got a lot of sympathy with some of the scholars who have argued, for example, Vincent Chow in a book last year called Criminal Law in the Modern Administrative State, which is a really excellent book, argues that, there is no ultimate normative justification for criminal law. The justification for criminal law is ultimately dependent on the justification for the state of which the criminal law is a very key part. So I don't, in the book, and this is, you know, part of the other chapter, I don't go into a very illinormative justification for any particular criminal law system, and I certainly don't make the assumption that that all criminal law systems, even the English one, are in fact justified. Certainly not in all of their aspects. But I do think essentially that the role of criminal law that potentially justifies it is this role in coordinating peaceful coexistence and protecting important shared and individual interests.
Thank you. And I think one of the arguments you make in this context is that the criminal law itself is politicized, in this, especially with the rise of democracy. The governments do have to answer.
Yeah, so I mean, the rise of democracy and those political institutions are themselves a very important part of the institutional context in which the modern criminal law develops.
Yeah, and also in terms of, you talk a bit about how the modern criminal law has developed and it's how it's changed, especially in the last century, in the concepts of mens rea in relation to, because of the growth of like medical and psychological and psychiatric knowledge as well. And can you talk a little bit about how this has influenced the notion of responsibility and also ideas of personhood and mens rea and how these relate?
Yes, I think that was one of the very big sort of intellectual, cultural, as well as, of course, institutional changes, because, of course, just as the legal system was professionalizing and centralizing in the 19th century, so was the medical profession emerging and forms of what we would now call psychiatric medicine beginning to emerge as distinct specialisms within that broad, you know, group of clinical activities. And I think what that did was super important because it helped to, if I can put it in this clumsy way, sort of psychologize the criminal law's notion of responsibility. I don't really think until the late 19th century the criminal trial was set up, either in terms of its rules or its institutional framework, as a way of trying to investigate the state of mind of an individual. But I think that gradually, and you know, that the idea that was the central role of the criminal trial does start to come in and really becomes, by the middle of the 20th century, a sort of paradigm notion of what a criminal trial is for. And I think that although it wasn't the only factor, the growth of the sorts of understandings of what it is to be a human being that came and to either have or lack capacity for one's actions that were being elaborated in part by psychiatric medicine was a very important part of that movement and a very good example of how ideas and institutional developments in the medical profession really intersect with one another.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com. NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, I think that's interesting because I think sometimes they go together and they work well together, and then at other times there can be a conflict between how lawyers and judges interpret medical evidence and how psychiatrists and the medical profession, how much certainty they can deliver. Whereas in criminal law, we're looking for kind of a dichotomous outcome, like guilty or not guilty, whereas the medical profession is kind of, it's never going to be certain. So I think
that's right.
It's interesting how these mesh together and how the criminal law has had to adapt and how far it has adapted and the extent to which it hasn't been able to accommodate all the time. And so there is this change notion of responsibility, which comes back, I think, to your categories of capacity, character, outcome, and risk, and how these go together and can exist alongside each other or in a tension as well at the same time.
So what the criminal process is doing is sort of recoding that information that's coming in from other discourses and professions like the medical profession via expert testimony, but using it to produce a binary legal coding of guilty or not guilty, responsibility or not responsibility. But there is something very distinctive that is going on with legal doctrinal argument. I'm not at all resisting that insight in the book, but I am really insistent that nonetheless all that information and from the social world plus the institutions through which these communications are happening in the legal system are really crucial to the development of criminal law.
Yeah, and that goes towards, I think, your third chapter in the book, talking about interests and there being interests that influence the criminal law and its development, and of course the notion of responsibility. You break it down into three sections, and I'm wondering if you can talk about each. Firstly, you talk about how interests have shaped the notion of strict liability and also corporate responsibility. Can you explain what this means? I'll just kind of finish the question, actually. And you also talk about how theft has changed over time. And actually, you addressed this earlier about the politicization of law. But if you could begin by talking about how interests have shaped the evolution of strict liability and corporate responsibility, that'd be great.
Right. So there's a lot of very, very good socio-legal and historical work on the development of strict liability offences in the 19th century in England, where it's very obvious that they were a key way in which industrial production and urbanisation were being regulated. So you have this huge development going on in England, in particular industrialised quite early. That implied quite a lot of urbanisation. There was a huge challenge for the state to organise health and safety, labour standards, these sorts of very basic things. And the criminal law became one of the sort of go-to tools. And there's a big debate about how long that had been going on for. There was quite a lot of, so as we would call it today, regulatory legislation in the 18th century too. But it definitely got a new spin with the development of the urbanised and industrial economy. The argument that I then draw on, which is originally a Marxian argument, but it's been developed in interesting ways by lots of criminal law scholars, is that, interestingly, we might think of this development of regulatory strict liability offences as a sort of, in a way, rebalancing power. After all, a lot of the people or organisations who were subject to this kind of criminalisation would have been firms, employers, and so on, collectivities of one kind or another, who we would typically think of as being more powerful and also standing to gain quite a lot from these economic developments. But the other thought, and this comes back really to the sort of legitimating role of criminal law, is that one of the things that is going on with this proliferation of strict liability offences in the 19th century has to do actually with kind of legitimising that distribution of power by saying implicitly, well, we are holding you to a certain standard of, you know, decent outcomes in terms of safety, health, licensing, and so on, as a basis for your having this kind of autonomy and power. So that, seen from that point of view, the regulatory offences aren't just about regulating dangerous activities in the emerging industrial economy and the intensely overcrowded urban spaces that were developing, but it's also about legitimising a certain new phase of capitalist development. And that's an argument which I draw on in the book and which has been elaborated very well by my colleague Alan Norrie.
And I think that links to your argument in regards to theft as well, and how the changing nature of the law of theft reflects back the social distribution of wealth and the political and how it's changed over time, especially in relation to how capitalism has developed. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, so I think there's an absolutely marvellous, quite old now, piece of scholarship that I draw on here by the American scholar George Fletcher, who wrote a book called Rethinking Criminal Law back in the 1970s, and he drew a distinction between what he called manifest and subjective criminality. And the idea of manifest criminality is just, you know, you know when something's a crime because you can just recognize it. And his argument was that if you look at the early law of theft, it's really all about recognizing, it's all about a physical taking that can be very easily recognized. We're not investigating the mental or psychological, let alone quasi-moral responsibility of the individual. And indeed, in the pre-modern era, the criminal law was very much about protecting property holdings, which were, of course, even more unequally distributed then than they are now. As we move into a more individualistic, democratized world from the 19th century on and through into the 20th century, one of the sort of founding ideologies of that democratic development is that, you know, of individualism, is that everybody has the opportunity to have property rights, even women from the late 19th century. That goes with a change in the way we think about theft, which is that since it's not now just about recognizing certain kinds of very class-based expropriation, but implicitly a much more, in principle, evenly distributed risk, if you like. We move here as well to the notion of sort of subjective criminality, the idea that ultimately the test of whether someone has stolen or not is not whether, you know, they've got goods that you don't think they look as though they shouldn't have, but whether they were dishonest in doing so, whether they intended to deprive another person. That's what legitimizes the law of theft. Does that help?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. No, it really does. And of course, George Fletcher's book is, and his work is so great. So it's interesting. I liked hearing your explanation. It kind of, I'll be honest, it breaks it down for me. It makes it a bit easier to understand. So thank you.
It's really interesting in terms of the kinds of evidence that becomes evident in these cases. This idea that it all turns on honesty, which has become really extremely true, certainly in English criminal law through the 20th century, is very interesting because it gives us a little glimpse into the way in which the criminal law is definitely trying to hold together some of the tensions that arguably surround claims of legitimacy in a capitalist economy, in which we know that actually property is massively unevenly distributed, and the what's more, that the boundaries between honesty and dishonesty and cunning enterprise are extremely thin. And that is a real tension that criminal law has to manage.
Yeah, it is interesting because a lot of it is almost false. We kind of attribute value to things like intellectual property, which obviously it has value, but in criminal law kind of puts, I guess, more value in a way into these kind of almost myths that, it's different to a plot of land, something that you can see and hold. And it's interesting then how it's changed over time.
Yeah.
And I can't help picking up when you mentioned that even women were able to own property at some stage. Because I know a lot of your work has been on gender, and in this book you talk a bit about how responsibility is and can be gendered historically, especially. Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yes, absolutely. So maybe I can just talk a little bit about the book I wrote immediately before this book, which yeah. is like a sort of companion book to it. And there's always a bit of serendipity to how one comes to write things. But I told you at the beginning of the interview, I started work in this field really about 20 years ago. And I was just getting into doing this work on responsibility when I was actually offered the papers to write a biography of H.L.A. Hart, famous legal philosopher. And I ran the two projects together for a while, but it was quite hard to do that. And in the end, I set this project aside, the criminal law project, and wrote the biography. And when I came back to the my responsibility project, I felt that I needed to sort of read my way back into it. And we're getting to gender, by the way.
Oh, it's all good. This is interesting.
I was already very interested in this big social debate, cultural debate in 18th century essays and plays about the notion of character and how important the notion of character was in how people read each other. And so I thought what I would do is spend my summer holiday that year reading lots of 18th century novels, because I knew that there was also a debate about character in the realist novels of the 18th century. And I was reading my way through this literature when I was invited to do a lecture for a friend of mine who'd just become the first woman dean at Toronto Law School on International Women's Day, and she said, I'd really like you to talk on a gender-related theme. And I said, well, I'm not working on gender at the moment. She said, oh, you can come up with something. And as luck would have it, the next novel in my pile was Daniel Defoe's novel, Moll Flanders. And mm-hmm. I read Moll Flanders, which is the tale of a swashbuckling, working class, sexually adventurous, recidivist thief. And she's the heroine of a novel. And I found myself thinking, what happened to Moll Flanders? Because by the time we get to the end of the 18th century, all the heroines are, middle class, polite, and very, 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 very well behaved. And then if you get to the end of the 19th century, I sort of thought of Tess of the D'Urbervilles, who does, exert some agency and independence and is, very, very harshly punished for it. And so I began to think that disappearance of a sort of very agentic offender, female offender, as, a possible heroine of a novel, told us something quite profound about what was happening to gender relations in that 200-year period. But also might well give us some insights into what was happening in the criminal law, because strangely enough, as you probably know, one of the very few things that is almost universally true of criminal justice systems is that they identify women as offenders to a very, very, you know, minor degree. So you, in most systems today, women remain only something like 5 to 10% of those convicted of the most serious crimes. But funnily enough, just around the time that Defoe was writing Roll Flanders, which was on the cusp of the 17th to 18th centuries, there was actually the Old Bailey, which is the main criminal court in London, for several of those years, tried more women for theft than it tried men. So I started to think that there might be something, an analogy, as it were, between the disappearance of the female offender from the polite realist novel and the relative disappearance of women from the criminal courts. And that resulted in a book called Women, Crime and Character. And essentially what I argued in that book, using a whole array, actually, of cultural resources as well as novels, plus a lot of old cases, case law over that period, and obviously what was happening in legislation and as well. I argued that in some ways that predominant way of thinking about responsibility in terms of character in the 18th century was in a way more conducive to thinking of women as full criminal subjects, if you mind putting it in that way. In the sense that although obviously notions of bad character would be highly gendered, nonetheless you could come up with distinctively female gendered notions of bad character and male gendered notions of bad character. There's no problem about thinking about women as having bad character. It's been something that has been done with great efficiency over most of the course of human history. What then happens as capacity and a more psychologized, but particularly capacity, agency, and the power to understand and control one's behavior start to become a more dominant way of our thinking about what makes people responsible, and then gradually, slowly, we start institutionalizing that in the criminal justice system. This happens at just the same time as women socially are actually being more and more discipline, particularly through forms of sexual discipline, discipline of sexual behavior, discipline, high discipline of comportment, as a sort of the emergence of a standards of bourgeois morality and the idea of a sort of what if you want to count as an emerging bourgeois respectable man who's pushing up through to this new class of merchants and then industrialists, not the new people who are pushing for political power, not the old landed people, but the new middle, you know, what will become in time middle classes. One of their marks of respectability is having a very, very well-disciplined wife. And things really get, I think, a lot worse for women in terms of their power to exercise their own agency and have their social agency recognized publicly during the late 18th and particularly the 19th centuries. And I think that's reflected in the criminal law. So in a way, Women, Crime and Character told the female gender side of this long development from character to capacity in the 18th and 19th centuries. And one thing I sort of slightly regret about the last book is that, in a sense, because I've done this book specifically thinking about women, I feel that gender probably drops out of my analytic view in this latest book a little bit more than it should have done. It's a very interesting lesson as to how hard it is to hold in one's head the whole time frames of reading law as an institution, as a social practice, as a set of doctrines, which are in some ways countercultural, reading against grain. You know, to read law in a gendered way is to try to attend to something that we know is there in the way law works, but which is not announced on the surface of law. It's a very typical sort of
critical move in scholarship, and it takes an enormous amount of effort and attention. And I had a lot of plate spinning in this book, and I think maybe the gender plate got a little bit lost.
But it's still really interesting. And what I loved in this book and what you've just talked about now is how you do make references to literature, and you use literature to look at, you know, what we value as a culture and what we, how we think of women. In this book, you talk about how we think of madness as well, and, you know, insanity, and mental health issues. I mean, it sounds like a fabulous summer when you're reading all of this 18th century literature.
It was.
Yeah, it's great. And I loved when I was reading In Search of Criminal Responsibility, Ideas, Interests and Institutions, how you did make reference to the concepts of insanity and madness. For example, you talk about Jekyll and Hyde and similar books. It was great just seeing how the criminal law reflects back, you know, what is in literature, but they go together, like they walk together. It's not, we can't just analyze the doctrine. So, for example, the McNaughton defense, that can't be removed from the wider context. And I do think you captured that, especially in relation to madness and, you know, what you've just talked about now in terms of the kind of medicalization of women and their criminality.
Yeah.
And I think we still see that today. You know, in some crimes, for example, like infanticide, that women can be found guilty of, but not men. You know, women are mad, but men are bad, I think oversimplify it.
I quite agree with you. I think it's quite remarkable how persistent these associations and stereotypes have been. And in some ways, a couple of years ago, I did a lecture at the British Academy in which I brought the women crime and character analysis up through the 20th century, which was incredibly difficult to do because there are just so many cultural media now. You know, it's not just novels. In the second half of the 20th century, it's also films and TV shows. And so, you know, it's a much harder thing to do with any kind of rigor in your sampling or and so on. But nonetheless, I think I made a fairly good case for the fact that in some ways, some of these stereotypes have become even more pernicious. And there's almost, in some of the novels, and even including very recent novels, almost a way in which women are being sort of blamed for their own victimization. And I think that, you know, that there is absolutely no way in which gender issues and criminal law have got any better. If anything, they just change their shape. There's a huge need for feminist work on criminal law.
Mm. And I think while it's not the main topic of this book, you do capture these changed notions of responsibility over time, and you can't escape the gendered notion of that. And I do think you capture it, even if, yeah, it's not the main topic.
Very kind of you.
Yeah, no, it's true. And so finally, just bringing all of these the ideas, interests, the institutions together. Can you talk a little bit about what you think the implications for legal theory and scholarship are, about, you know, your history of responsibility and also the changing notion of responsibility?
Well, I think the main implication for legal scholarship, for legal theory, the implication is that, a lot of legal theory has been, in my view, too fixated on coming up with a very coherent account of what criminal law is all about and being not very attentive to the complexity and sometimes, as you put it, the tensions in the way in which criminal law ideas are organized and institutionalized. And I like to think of this as a very much a sort of social constructionist approach to legal theory. It's very much not a form of realism or idealism. It's a way of saying, you know, when we're doing legal theory, we're doing a theory of a very complex phenomenon. And we have to think all the time reflexively about what the criteria of accountability are between that phenomenon, or those phenomena, those practices, and our theorization. And I think a lot of criminal law theory in particular, but I think it's true of tort theory and any kind of applied legal theory, is often very quick to just marginalize and stop talking about the aspects of the actual phenomena out there in the legal system, which don't fit their model. And in criminal law, the obvious long-standing example is the whole terrain of regulatory offences, which for many, many years were just sort of put in a last chapter or regarded as a kind of exception to the general principles of criminal law that was a bit embarrassing and we shouldn't talk about it too much. And so I think that isn't pleasing to some of the more philosophical kinds of legal theorists, because there are real criteria of a sort of aesthetics of coherence and also sometimes very sort of moralized principles at work in what some of those theorists see as an appealing theory. But I think it's super important myself to be constantly and reflexively moving back and forth between the phenomena and our theory, and being very self-critical about what those criteria of accountability are. So what does it mean exactly to say my theory is a theory of criminal law, if it doesn't say anything about a very big part of the terrain of criminal law, if it marginalises strict liability or guilty pleas as an institutional arrangement? That would be another good example. I mean, the huge preponderance of the guilty plea as an institutional phenomenon in criminal justice systems is a central part of how they work. We can't theorize it away. We may not like it, we may have criticisms of it, but if we want to understand how criminal law works, what its meaning is in society, we have to have the guilty plea as part of our account. So those are the implications for legal theory, and for legal scholarship, I think it does mean that having, you know, historical perspectives are very useful, because they help us to look afresh at things that we sometimes take for granted. And I think the same is true actually for comparative scholarship. And I think it does also imply that socio-legal insights aren't just a sort of exotic optional extra. They're really very central to the whole way in which legal scholarship ought to proceed.
Yeah, I think those are very wise words, both in terms of theory, reminding ourselves to be self-critical of the theory that we're coming up with and reflecting back about, you know, what it actually means and how it plays out. You talk in your book about the difference between law in the books and law in action. So I think, yeah, being self-critical, and also then, again, in terms of scholarship, always looking afresh. I think that's so important, and it's, you know, it's so easy to kind of get stuck in institutions and ideas and interests that have always been, and see them as justifications in themselves, as neutral, when I don't think that's always the case. And Nicola, I've taken up a lot of your time now, and I'm very grateful for it. Can I just ask you before you go what you're working on now?
Well, very sweet. I have a couple of projects. I work actually with my husband, David Soskus, who's a political scientist, on the comparative political economy of crime and punishment. So roughly speaking, why do countries have such different patterns of crime and punishment, and how does that relate to the way their political, economic and social systems work? And I wrote a book about that about 15 years ago, and I'm now working with David on a series of papers, particularly on why America is such an outlier as compared with other liberal market countries, capitalist countries with advanced democracies. I also work with a philosopher and psychotherapist called Hannah Pickard, who's at Johns Hopkins University, on how we might rethink various aspects of the criminal justice system in terms not of blame, but in other words, in ways that would distance the affective kind of blaming and stigmatization, which we know to be so inimical to reintegration of offenders, and even to see if we can think of ways of redesigning the criminal justice system in order to facilitate what we might call institutional counterparts of forgiveness. So those are two broad projects. And then, of course, I have a wonderful time engaging with other people's work. And going back to what we were saying about feminist theory, I've just written a review of Nari Nassim's wonderful new book, Criminal Law and the Man Problem. Also, you were asking particularly about the medicalization of women. I've engaged a lot recently with the work of a very interesting young Australian scholar called Arlie Loughnan, who wrote a wonderful book called Manifest Madness. So, you know, I see my own work is very, very much in dialogue with and inspired by lots of other people's work. It's not an individual process, really.
They all sound very interesting projects, and it sounds like you're going to be very busy. So once again, thank you, Nicola, for your time. Nicola Lacey's book is In Search of Criminal Responsibility, Ideas, Interests and Institutions. It's published by Oxford University Press. And I can honestly say I really recommend it for anyone who's interested in law, philosophy, history of criminal law, and, of course, criminal law in particular. Thank you so much for your time, Nicola.
It's a great pleasure, Jane. Thank you.